What I want to talk about is the law of cure, also known as the healing crisis. And from a traditional Chinese point of view, it's called the turning point. And it's the transition between hexagram 23 and 24 in the I Ching. It's one of the foundational concepts of Chinese physiology, Chinese cosmology, Chinese philosophy. It's one of the most important foundational aspects in the whole medicine. And
which hexagrams?
23 and 24. I cover it in Chapter 7 of Nourishing Destiny. And whatever chapter I wrote about the husband-wife imbalance in. And it impressed me so much that those hexagrams are the cover of clinical practice book. Friedhof Kapper wrote a book called The Turning Point in around 1980. So it's really important to understand, especially in light of how much fuzzy thinking there is around it and how much new age fuzzy thinking there is about it. So essentially the notion is, in the broadest perspective, that we, in the Tao Te Ching, the central character Da, right, means original nature and virtue. So in the infant, it's original nature, and in the sage, in the adult, it's virtue. Now, the two things are not the same thing. Original nature is emptiness. It's potential. So original nature is the potential inherent in emptiness. Virtue is the actual manifestation of that in the world as a living presence through speech and through action. Original nature is the lower order manifestation. And virtue is the higher order manifestation. Original nature we get for no reason whatsoever. We're all imbued with it at the moment of conception. It's impersonal. God bless you. It's impersonal. And it has nothing to do with you. So ultimately, the void, emptiness, the unborn, is the infinite ground beneath all of our feet. Right? So kidney one, bubbling spring. You're standing on this infinite ground of infinite potential with this infinite source of undifferentiated pure potential energy supporting the incarnation. And that's absolute, and it's that same emptiness for all of us. Empty is empty. Now, on a personal and a human level, when we come into this world, while we all have the same potential in terms of becoming vehicles for the evolution of consciousness and giving to that, we all have our own potentials. I mean, some of us are just might be inherently good in math, and some are inherently more compassionate, and some are inherently a very good structural visualization, and some might have a very good sense of direction, and some might have a beautiful voice with no training whatsoever, or a God-given gift of musical ability. And some might just, make very good accountants. Which, not to diminish it, I mean, somebody, right? I mean, we all have... Right. God bless the good accountants, right? I'm thankful for mine every year, man. So the thing is that we all have different abilities in that way, but just beneath that, all of that would be for bringing spirit into the world, and that's impersonal. So all the things which we're good at would just be, all the skills we have would be just vehicles and conduits for the emergence into the world of this undifferentiated impersonal potential. So that's original nature. Virtue is the accumulated outcome of the choices we make. It's very different from original nature. So the degree of virtue that we manifest in the world is directly related, it's an external manifestation of and directly related to the actual condition of our souls beyond our fantasies of like, in my heart I'm a really good person. Do you see? So the degree of virtue we're manifesting, the degree of light that's actually coming through our eyes, is an outer reflection of the actual quality of our soul. And the quality of our soul at any moment, the condition of our soul, is a direct result of the consequences of the choices that we've made and the choices that we're making.
Wait, the soul is
the quality of the soul, the state of the soul.
The state of the soul.
The state of the soul. So while spirit is untouched and always pure, always that clear light of God, our soul is like the carrier. Our soul, the quality of our soul reflects the degree to which we've lived up to what we've seen about spirit. Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So Adolf Hitler may have had this mind-blowing spiritual realization in that ditch during World War I when he was mustard gassed. He had a complete, apparently non-dual realization, but the conclusion he drew in that moment was, I have to kill all the Jews in the world. Mm-hmm. So there's no such thing as Hitler's spirit. Hitler's spirit's the same as our spirit. There's just one spirit and it's all good. It's all light. But what would the condition of his soul be if you could look at it? I mean, Gollum would look like a high fashion model compared to, you know, Lord of the Rings. You should see Lord of the Rings, the tall trilogy. Make sure Anna sees Lord of the Rings. Yeah, it's a beautiful metaphor for the spiritual quest. And it's all Christian, so you'll dig it. All Christian metaphor, and it's extremely powerful. And they're three of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen. And will take the place of hallucinogens without having to pay the price for them any day. So having created this as a big background, well, let me continue because I'm on a roll here. So the issue here is that we're born with original nature. We become enculturated, we draw conclusions. The ego establishes the illusion of a separate self. And for those fortunate enough in this lifetime, we can have a moment where we see through all that. And in that moment, we can see the created self is an illusion. It was an illusion, it is an illusion, it will always be an illusion, it isn't true, there never was anything true there, nothing ever happened, everything's fine, I have always been free. I am free. I could never be anything but free. I am not a victim. I always knew what I was doing. I'm going through the tenets here. I always knew what I was doing. I am not that created self. I am this impersonal light. That is who and what I really am. And my sole motivation is to bring this into the world for the sake of everybody else. And that's all that's real. And we can see all that in a moment. And the feeling is though one is born again. One has the experience of being born again in this life. Now, being born again is not just a Christian metaphor. The Taoists talked about being born again for 2,000 years. They talked about cultivating the spiritual embryo and becoming that light. That was the whole purpose of Taoist practice. Louis Ming, who I translated in my book, who wrote in 1810, that was all that he was about. Cultivating the spiritual embryo, being born again, becoming the light. So it sounds Christian, but it's the basis of all traditions I've ever studied. So the thing is, we can have the experience, we can see it all, and we can think in the moment of our revelation that we can recognize we've been born again, and we can think, there it is, I'm enlightened. Do you see? There it is, I'm enlightened. I'm enlightened because I can see all of it. I've seen through the created self. I can see that there is no other, that I am, in my the deepest and best part of myself, the one intelligence in this whole universe. The one soul, the one heart, the one light. That's who and what I am, and we can see that. And then most of us, sooner or later, find out that everything else we had seen through hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't gone anywhere. So I can remember being completely and thoroughly enlightened on the first retreat I ever did with Andrew, and I was. Absolutely. Saw the whole thing. I don't know, and it may sound arrogant, but I don't think that Andrew or Ramana Maharshi or Jesus Christ saw more than I saw. I mean, one is one. It's just one is one. When you see that you are, in reality, the one God, and that's all you are, and that's all that there is in the whole universe, and that everything, even this cup, is consciousness, and there is nothing but consciousness and light, and everyone is that. What else? I mean, I don't know what else there is to see, and maybe there is something, but that's all they said. And I've seen all they said. And then I can remember thinking, this is it. I've studied enlightenment my whole life. I recognized it in a minute. This is it. And then I was completely outraged. Then 5 days later, I started having thoughts. And I'd have thoughts like, she's pretty hot. Go, where's that coming from? Why is that still there? And I'd like to do this, and I'd like to do that. And why did this patient cancel, you know, not come to their appointment and not cancel? And what about this? And how come my class isn't filling up? And all these thoughts are coming in, and I remember sitting there going, wait a second, I don't understand. I thought that I was done. You see, because we have this myth. Yeah. There's this, Christians have their myths. And the Eastern myth is, you become enlightened and your ego's dead. That's the Eastern myth. And that we all narcissistically hold out for. Well, I'll sit around. We all think, eventually when the time is right, in this lifetime or some other lifetime, I'll be enlightened and then I'll be done. And I can sit on a hammock and wait for it, because that's the way everything's going, and God will enlighten me when God thinks I'm ready. And then when that finally happens eventually, I won't have these crazy thoughts or feeling anymore. I'll be nothing but light. It's all up to God. God is doing it. Do you see? So, like all of us, that's what I thought. And I thought, okay, boom, here it is. It finally happened. I learned classical Chinese. I took LSD. I meditated. I read Baba Ram Das and Carlos Castaneda and The Third Eye. And I read all the books and I heard all these teachers. And it's my time, man. Here I am. I'm totally enlightened. And my mind was going crazy. I remember being on the treadmill a couple days later running, thinking, these idiots, I could go to the Middle East and make peace in 3 seconds because there's nothing but light, and it would be apparent to anyone in my presence there was nothing but light. You see? So the thing is, the thoughts start coming in, and you realize, oh my God, none of... And then eventually, and I kept thinking, well, okay, these thoughts are there, but this is all cleared up. That'll never come back. And then eventually you get hit a stage where you realize, I'm the exact same person I was before the experience. Nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is, one, I have to admit that I can no longer be cynical in life. In other words, I can never adopt a position of ignorance and cynicism again, because now I know what's true. And before I suspected what was true and had an intuition about what's true, but now I know unequivocally what's true. And also now, because I know it, I can never indulge thoughts of doubt or cynicism anymore and have integrity, because now I know what's true. It's not just a question of having read it in books or having vague intuitions. Now I've seen the whole thing, so I know that it's so. So that had changed. But beyond that, I still wanted what I wanted and was afraid what I was afraid of and desired what I desired and was still a completely conditioned, arrogant, postmodern, narcissistic, intelligent, overly intellectual, well, let's not say overly intellectual, but primarily developed in the realm of intellect, guy. With all the condition, the Jewish conditioning, the American conditioning, it was all there. You see? And then you have to get out the shovel and start digging. And start working. Right? So start taking your conditioning on so you can actually so that your life becomes more and more and more and more of a reflection of what it is you've actually seen. That's actually so. And when you do that, when you start shifting your identity to the higher truth you've seen, the thing, which is the ego that's had your attention for 30, 40, 50 years, it's not going to lay down and die. It's not going to say, okay, I've had your attention for 40 years. Why do, you know, give God your attention for 40, and then after that we'll see how things come out. And it's not its position. Its position is it knows exactly what physical sensations, what thoughts, and what emotions to generate to get all your attention directly back on it in a way that creates cynicism and doubt about what you've seen of a higher nature and about your ability to ever live up to it. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the big context. And then the question is, what are you going to do in the face of that? What are you going to do? So in the face of the cynicism and the doubt and the crazy thoughts and the body pains and the flurry of neurotransmitter hormonally induced emotions, what are you going to do? Are you going to stay true to what you've seen? This is what my teacher Andrew did. Mm-hmm. In the face of all the insanity, he decided, I'm never stepping away from this, and he hasn't. So what are you going to do in the face of it? And that's what determines ultimately the outcome of your life. It's not what you've seen. It's not what you've experienced. It's strictly, to what degree did you care enough to give your life to what you saw? To become that in the world. See, to become that. And that determines the outcome of your life. Mm-hmm. So that when you die and you have that infinite second of looking in God's eyes to account for the outcome, are you going to be able to sit there and say, I saw and I did it? Or when God said, well, did you do it? Are you going to go, well, you know, whatever. No, well, kind of. You're going to list for God, well, here's a list of all the good things that I did do. And because, see, God's going to see it all. And not only is God going to see it all, when you're dead, you won't have an ego, so you won't be able to hide any of it from yourself.
Wow.
Do you see? And you're going to answer to whatever God you're going to answer to at your level of development. So it's going to be exactly the God that's right for you. In other words, it's going to be the presence of that which you cannot deny is real. However that occurs in your life. Do you see? If you're a Kalahari Bushman, it might be a tree spirit. If you're a Christian, it might be a white guy with a beard. And if, you know... Charles Darwin. I mean, whatever. It'll be a Bill Gates designed PC. And say, hey, hello, Hal. What kind of life did you lead? I mean, I don't know, you know, but the point is each person, for each person. You kind of get the idea with a lot of people who say they're atheists, that it's really just the position they're taking. You know? My father, an atheist, my father is as vehemently atheist as the most fundamental, I mean, Jimmy Swaggart. Is not more of a Christian than my father is an atheist. And you get the idea that there's a lot of energy behind it. Anyway, moving on. The point here is that when a person takes a stand for something higher, there's going to be a huge arising of a force within them to resist it. Now, we can call this ego backlash. So just, if you can think for yourself at a mundane level of, have you ever noticed in a relationship when you achieve a very beautiful point of intimacy, minutes later you start closing off to it? Like, you know, you've just, you know, had this beautiful, beautiful moment and everything was there and you were both totally open and all of a sudden you feel the boundaries start closing. Back in the day when we used to take hallucinogens, like you'd go out with four or five friends and you'd all take this stuff and you'd be sitting there on the dock and everyone would be like, I love you guys so much. And everyone would be together in this field and there'd be this powerful recognition of one and just this mind-blowing, mind-blowing beauty. And then the drug would start wearing off and there'd become a moment, everyone would be laughing and all of a sudden there'd be this one moment and it'd be like, and the inclination then was, does anyone have any more? Maybe we should, you know, right? So the thing is that the filter is mechanically built into our nervous system to only let in as much reality as we can handle or want to handle, are willing to handle. The amount of reality we're willing to handle is directly related to how much we care about the biggest possible picture. Now, the action of that filter is just mechanically...
Could you say that sentence one more time, please?
Yeah, so from a certain point of view, a psychological point of view, you could say that the ego is a filter that lets in only as much reality as we can handle at any moment. Now, that's a humanistic psychological formulation. It's not can handle at any moment, because we are all built to handle all of it. Because fundamentally, our consciousness is God's consciousness. And God has no problem handling reality. The issue really is how much are we willing to handle, because when we let in the bigger picture, one, it's painful because we see how much karma we're creating, how much misery and suffering we're creating, just how selfish we are in the face of our greater realization. So the issue here is really one of of using will, using our own will out of care, being so conscious at this level of development that we are going through realization and through will, through the sincere application of will, we are going to defeat the mechanistic nature of this filter. See? We're going to get into the... We can see it, and we know how it works now. It's not an evolutionarily hidden mystery anymore, like it has been for 4,000 years and was in the 1950s. We now have a perspective on it we can understand without myth and superstition. We can understand its action as a structure in consciousness, emerging from the nervous system, built in evolutionarily, but consciousness can now see the ego. It can see it. It can understand the physiological and neurophysiological and the functional basis of it. And we can see it working, and we can use will that even though it's still there, we can function beyond it, outside of it, even though it's still there. But unlike the Eastern myth that it's going to disappear, we can actually, it doesn't matter if it disappears anymore, because we can get to a point of development where we're taking full responsibility for it. We just have to bear it. We have to be willing to bear it, even though it's still there.
And in terms of Chinese physiology, would you relate this to that will as being the kid?
It's the
kidney axis and how
it's the sure.
By the middle gel.
It's the sure. It's the will.
But it's a bit. Is there even perhaps a medical aspect to the capacity for this to shine through in terms of the middle jaw and its interference with the heart kidney?
At the level of consciousness, it doesn't matter how much liver qi stagnation you have.
Really?
Absolutely. Well, I wrote this in a post recently that everything I'm talking about in this domain is free of physiology. Consciousness is free of physiology. I mean, it didn't. Christopher Reeves had every problem everywhere, and it didn't stop his consciousness. Nelson Mandela was in a jail cell 28 years. It didn't stop his consciousness. There, unless you have real organic brain pathology, there's nothing in the way of any of this. And even for some people with organic brain pathology, I mean, if you want to be free, you're going to be free. Nothing can stop it. It's absolute. It's consciousness. It never enters the stream of becoming. Consciousness is never victimized by the failure of matter. It's a good sentence. You should write it down. So consciousness is never victimized by problems with matter. The problem with human being isn't our physical structure, right? Humanity isn't having problems because of our physical structure. It's having problems because of the choices we've been making.
Yep. When you started the lecture, you mentioned it was original nature in virtue. Is that correct? And in virtue, is there... in original nature, is there only the absolute or authentic self? And in
authentic self is...
If I can just say one last
part. But you're mixing metaphors.
Okay.
Original nature is potential.
All right.
It's the unborn. It's the potential present in Jing at the moment of conception.
Okay.
That fuels the development of the fetus, but the fetus isn't making decisions. I think I'll build more mitochondria. So this potential is unfolding.
Right.
Virtue is the willed tapping into that potential to manifest the highest attribute and motives inherent in emptiness in the world practically.
It seems like there's God, though, in original nature. Is that...
Potentially.
Okay.
Only as a potential.
Okay.
See, this is the thing. The traditional teachings define God only as that unmanifest.
Okay.
But through an evolutionary perspective, a developmental perspective, we realize that to the degree of a person's development, God is able to actually enter the world in manifestation through action, through the awakened human being. God can't do that as the infinite void.
You mean as emptiness?
No, from an evolutionary perspective, the traditional Eastern and West, even in Western teachings, God is always beyond this world.
But isn't that the whole point of Christianity? God came to earth as a man?
Well, yeah, but that happened once a long time ago.
So is original nature like zero, and virtue would be like the plus one?
Exactly. The presence of virtue in the world is a complete denial of the motives of ego. So the motives of ego are always selfish and motivated by fear and desire. And the presence of virtue is always that luminous potential of integrity, compassion, insight, beyond. Right? Beyond ego.
Okay.
You said something very poetic. Virtue is the will tapping into emptiness. You wrote that down.
Well, virtue is the manifestation of potential in the world manifested through will. Right? Yeah, when we use our will to bring potential into the world to manifest virtue. But let me move on. Okay. So this is the background for understanding the turning point, the law of cure. So from this perspective, as a person loses original nature, becomes hypnotized by the ego, sees through the ego ideally, and then starts building conviction so that their life becomes more and more and more and more of a reflection of that infinite potential and glory they've seen beyond ego. And a person's building and building and building, moving ahead in their face of the resistance. There comes a moment in time where the person is seriously considering giving their life to this, which means switching their identity. Really switching their identity, reconciling with themselves, really looking at themselves and really owning up to what they've seen, what they know is true, what isn't true. They're ready to renounce doubt. Mm. They're ready to renounce cynicism for all time, to give up the right to indulge in ego. Mm. They're putting their stake in the ground and saying, my life is for the emergence of the authentic self, for truth, for light into the world. That's who and what I am, and the rest of my life is for the emergence of it. And as a person is on the crux of doing this, the ego is going to go insane. So we can see in myth, Christ has this dark night of the soul, of temptation, right? And you just stay with the metaphor, and I'm sure you understand from your own life that moments in life where you took a real stand with real conviction for something greater, there became a point where everything came up to take you in the other direction, and you just had to, you had to decide, am I doing this or am I not doing this? Am I going to or am I not? And it's an absolute decision.
Yeah.
And you can never go back. And there's no guarantee before you do it how it's going to look like after you do it. And the ego's like, well, I'll do it, but I want to know. And no one can ever know. No one can ever tell you. You see? So ultimately, in terms of the spiritual path, there comes this moment where you realize my life is for the evolution of spirit in the world. It isn't my life. It never was. I'm a vehicle for the evolution and the emergence of this into the world, and I'm willing to give my life to that no matter what it takes, because I recognize that's the most important thing. Now, that's a huge step, and only at that step has a person really grappled with the first tenet of this teaching, which is, it's only the beginning. It's like black belt. You train for 5 or 6 years waiting for your black belt test, and your teacher finally hands you your black belt and you realize, I don't know anything. So the whole spiritual path is building up to this moment of conviction. And then after that, we find out, oh, the ego still hasn't gone anywhere. It's going to be an eternity now of taking on the ego. And you know, at this level you discern, it isn't my ego. There's one ego in the entire universe, and I've just taken on the whole thing. Do you see? It's not just... See, from a humanistic psychological perspective, we thought, I just have to overcome my problems. My cousin did this to me when I was 5. My father did this. My mother did this. My girlfriend did this. My wife's doing that. And I have to overcome and work out all these problems. And you grapple with all this, and you've seen through that whole self. In spiritual, that whole self was never real, and you grapple with all of this, and you give your life to the authentic self, and then you realize that there is only one authentic self in this universe. It's a very significant part of God. It's not personal. No, the authentic self. And then you realize, and there's only one ego in the universe, and I thought I had to overcome my problems compared to what I'm taking on. I didn't really have any problems. It's much bigger than just what my boyfriend did or what my uncle did when I was 5 or the fact that, you know, I had a smoking problem or a drinking problem or, you know, or 2 divorces or whatever. It's much, you realize, oh my God, it's of cosmic proportion. Then everything starts getting very interesting, and then you start coming to these moments of cynicism and doubt over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. But you keeps the more you step beyond them and stay true to that stake you planted in the ground, the more conviction you have in the whole process and the more liberation there is. And it goes on and on and on. Okay, so that's the spiritual picture of the turning point. I wrote all about it in terms of hexagram 23 and 24 and the husband-wife imbalance in my 2 books, which is the medical condition. Moving on from that to medicine, the notion here on a more mundane level is that when a patient comes to us for healing, if we're practicing in what I've termed the inner tradition, and we're not just using Chinese medicine to suppress symptoms, and it's just as easy to suppress symptoms with Chinese medicine, even easier in a way than with drugs, because Chinese medicine all goes down smooth. Do you see what I mean? So, you know, it goes down like licorice or sake or something. So it's all warm and fuzzy, and the person says, I'm taking responsibility for my health. You can still be suppressing symptoms with all of it. But if you're practicing in a real tradition, then the person is gaining increased integrity in all lines of development. And as the person comes closer and closer and closer to to that place in their life where they'd really be casting out the dysfunctional thoughts, the relationship to all the dysfunctional energies that are sustaining their illness, right? And really making meaningful changes and really taking a stand for everything they've seen and learned, there comes a moment of doubt, of cynicism. Why? Because the body knows just how to generate that pathology to make the person think that nothing has been happening in the clinic. So you can see, you can have 40 treatment sessions of notes where the person said, I'm getting better, 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 better. That can go on for 10, 20, 30, 40 treatment sessions. And you have all these notes, and better than ever, never thought I could feel like this. Feel like I did when I was 12, more energy, better sleep. And the person comes in and says, nothing's happened. Go, what? Go, I'm right back where I started, nothing's happened. But you said... And they said, but you said all this. And they go, well, I was just saying that because I, you know, was trying to give you good feedback about the treatment. They'll say stuff completely cynical about all the wholehearted endorsement of the process that they've given for 3 months or a year or a year and a half. Saying, nothing's happened. I'm right back where I started with. Completely cynical. Because the ego doesn't recognize the motives of the authentic self. When a person, you can only be identified with authentic self or ego. It's absolute. Now, you can go back and forth between the two so fast it's blinding.
Yep.
But in any moment in time, you can only be identified with the fears and desires of the ego or the pure, unselfish motive of the authentic self. And when the physical symptoms come up in a person, it's the body's last-ditch effort to rivet a person's attention away from the higher motivation of all the steps they've taken to get better. The person puts their attention on the symptoms, use it as proof that nothing's happened. All the cynicism and doubt is there. They're likely projecting this hostility on you. And the best... So then you have to understand what's happening. So I've just created a very large picture. The hallmark of this is that if it's a real law of cure reaction, there are some rules. The symptoms will never be worse than the worst incident the person has had prior. So it can be as bad as the worst migraine headache the person's ever had, but it shouldn't be worse. The symptoms should only last 48 hours. 72 tops. 3 days tops, not a second past 3 days, and 48 on average, before they start to significantly subside. And when the symptoms do subside, the person should be significantly better than before this episode. Because it's a fundamental and significant last rush of this particular dysfunctional dynamic out of the person. It's very easy to help the person through it. It rarely takes more than draining aggressive energy and or just doing like source and low points on their constitutional meridians. So, you know, liver 3, gallbladder 37, if there would.
So you're saying that along when the ego backlash kicks in, often physical symptoms.
No, I'm saying no, because ego backlash can be very subtle. Look, ego backlash is just a momentum. It's an internal experience. The fact that it's happening is irrelevant. All that matters is what our relationship is to it. Do you see? So if we don't act out of it, then it never happened.
I guess I got lost because it seemed like maybe I just missed the transition or something, but you were talking about how the person's been coming in for a year and a half doing great work, getting better.
Right.
And then they come in and they start to doubt.
Well, they come in and they say, I'm right back where I started, I feel just as bad as I ever did, nothing's happened.
Right, and along with that...
And you know what they're saying is completely crazy, and you have all the proof, and in the face of the proof, they come up with some cynical thing to support it.
How do we get from that to this law of cure reaction?
Because the law of cure reaction is the same thing. You've been treating the person, they've been doing well, they've been making changes, then all of a sudden all the symptoms are back, and just like Peter denying Christ 3 times, the person comes in and says, nothing's ever happened. And they completely deny all. Just like on the spiritual path, people will deny. I have seen people have complete awakening experiences. I mean, total illumination. Come to me on bended knee with tears in their eyes saying, my whole life's changed, nothing up to this point matters, I've been born again, thank you very much. And I remember this young girl looking at me and saying, do you know I've been having this affair with a married man, it's completely disgusting, I called him last night, told him it's off. And then going, you know, progressing on the path, giving it everything for 3 months, and then all of a sudden I don't hear from her anymore. And I call a few weeks later and say, what's going on? She said, you know, I just want different things in life. And I've gone back to this man. He's the one I want to be with and screw his wife and kids. And not really. And I said, but you told me you were reborn. She said, oh, yeah, well, I saw a lot. I mean, all that's true.
Right.
thank you very much, but do you see? But completely denying the whole insight she had had about how unwholesome what she was doing was, which only came from her. It didn't come from me.
I guess, to me, the two things seem fundamentally different, because...
Well, okay, that's all right. So, since they're exactly the same, you're going to tell me how they're different, and then we'll sort it out. So what's so?
Well, can I try so, at least?
Yeah, try.
Okay. It seems to me that, like, on the, with the ego, that kind of thing, with the doubting and, like, totally turning your back on everything you've seen, it's only productive if you bear it and stay true to what you've seen. Whereas with the law of pure, at least the way I understand it, the way you just described it, it's. Sounds like, you know, a clearing.
Like, not if the person cancels all their appointments, says acupuncture didn't work, and starts drinking coffee again. In other words, the person's coming in with all the doubt about everything that happened. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like an ego backlash. They're coming in with all the doubt. Remember, ego is the only internal cause of disease. It's the only internal cause. Which doesn't mean that that's proof that everyone who is illness is an ego. It doesn't mean that. Ego can be defined in many. So, I mean, there are discernments to make here. But ego is as much as a person can take responsibility for in terms of internal causes of disease. Let's put it that way. It's as much as a person can take responsibility for. In terms...
Humanist.
No, it's as much as you can take responsibility for. You can't take responsibility for your genetics. You can't take responsibility for the fact that your mother smoked while you were in utero. But you can take responsibility right now for being free. And when you're doing that, you're cutting the ego off at the root, so that ego isn't a source of input into illness. No, there still might be genetics, and from a certain standpoint, you can say that's ego. You can say it's the physical embodiment of karma, but you start to run into problems. You start to run into problems. It's not that that hasn't been said. The Indian, right, the whole caste system was based on that in India. If you're born poor, it's because you did something in your last life and you clean it up. It starts to get messy pretty quick. So, the point is, Andy, that someone's coming in with doubt. You can do aggressive energy in these source and low points, and usually all the symptoms will subside, the person will move through it, they'll have had a major clearing, and their health will be established at a whole higher level than it had been prior, because there's been a huge... Now, that doesn't mean they're free of ego. It just means that the energy underlying a major functional dynamic in them has gone from 99.9% down to 3%. Now, ego's still there, and there'll be other things, but I'm just talking this particular syndrome has left. Now, if the person calls and says, you know, denies everything and says, nothing's worked, and this happens all the time. We were just talking about it with Daniel. I was talking about it happens all the time that people get cynical about their own treatment and deny and stop treatment. So it's really the same phenomenon. So so Christ's dark night of the soul was a clearing. But what if he had decided, screw the crucifixion, screw the Romans, I'm going off with Mary and we'll just do our thing.
Right, and I guess that's because it just kind of, like, if you are able to kind of stay true to the higher values in the face of all that coming up in your ego, then that is kind of like, I mean, it might not actually go away and never come back again, but it's a certain amount of stuff.
No, but when you
kind of gain a lot more confidence in your ability to do that.
The bigger the thing you take on, the larger the amount of cynicism and doubt that arise, the greater the step you take forward in face of it, the more depth, wisdom, and confidence you build.
Come in with a complete flare-up of their symptoms, but not necessarily the doubt that goes along with it, would that still be that point of crisis? Because clinic had people come in and be like, oh, this is all flared up, but, you know, I know if we keep pushing this treatment, they're not doubting the treatment.
The point that I'm making... Okay, so that's a part of the functional process. But the point that I'm making is spiritually.
Okay.
On the path... Every one of us will eventually come to a final reckoning. And then once we've made that final reckoning, there will be infinite tests laying ahead. Infinite tests. You gotta see the three Lord of the Rings movies. You gotta see them. So there'll be infinite tests laying ahead of us. And, you know, but the more confidence and the more wisdom we develop and the more, you know, taking that step into the unknown in the face of our fear is what transforms fear into wisdom. Potential, you know, original nature into virtue. So, spiritually, there's going to come a point in everyone's spiritual path where it is no longer about incense and mantras and tantra and Buddhist chanting and going to church and singing hymns, just to, you know, bring you into it. So there's going to come a point where who and what a person thinks they are and who they thought God was and how they thought life was, there's going to come a point where the authentic step to take is just too much. Totally unreasonable. More than they ever could have imagined was being asked. More on the line to risk than they ever thought they'd have to put on the line to risk. Where it's just too much, and every part of them that they're identified with in terms of ego is morally and ethically outraged. Do you see? Where it's not fun and games, where it's not feeling good, where the choices, what it really comes down to is willingly crucifying yourself. You see, willingly crucifying yourself because you're ready to nail that ego up and let it hang there forever.
Yes.
On the cross. With no, and here's the thing that's different from, and here's the thing that's different from Christianity. You're not hanging it on the cross and a second later it's going to La La Land up on a cloud with Big Daddy. And there's not going to be a rebirth and everything's all right. You're hanging it up on the cross and it's going to stay there for 100 trillion years suffering. While you go into the light. You see?
Yeah.
And that's where it all gets very real. In a spiritual way. In a physical way, with medicine, with the practice of medicine, you can see this all the time because you know so-and-so is probably never really going to be able to eat wheat again, or sugar again, or dairy again, or smoke another cigarette, or have another affair. Do you see, they're never going to be, or look at pornography. Do you see, they're never going to be able to do it again, ever, because it's the basis of a habit so deep in psyche that if they have one grain of sugar, the whole syndrome pattern will explode. If they indulge and go to one porn site, or gamble $1, or eat, you know, one cruller. Or have one affair, do you see? The whole syndrome pattern will explode again, and they'll be back in hell, and it'll ruin all their confidence.
Different things for different people, like when we're talking.
Sure, yeah, different.
Some people can handle one crush, some people can't.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, I can eat chocolate, it's no problem. I have congestion, so I'm willing to live with a certain amount of congestion, and sometimes I go off all sugar for a week and everything clears up. Sometimes I have one piece of chocolate a week. Sometimes I have none for years. Sometimes I have, you know, but I'm making conscious choices about what I'm willing to live with. But I don't have a real particular problem with any of it. I never had anorexia, bulimia, thriving candida, huge diabetic or pre-diabetic condition. It's just not a big issue. So the worst that's going to happen is if I have too much chocolate, my sinuses drip for a few days. But for another person, if they have that, the whole universe of psychological, emotional, physical pathology is going to explode. I can gamble. I could go to a slot machine and drop in $20 worth of quarters. I'd be bored after a dollar. I'm just making a metaphor. And there's no chance that I'm going to gamble away my kid's education. But if somebody else drops a quarter in a slot machine, they're going to wind up destitute in the street. I can have 6 drinks a year. It's no problem. If I have 6 drinks a year, or 8, or even 12, there's no point that comes where I think, you know, I should really have 2 drinks. I should have 3 drinks. It's 10 in the morning. Maybe I should drink. That's never going to come. But somebody else should never have a drink. Right? And then there are some things that nobody should do, which means you shouldn't cheat on your partner, because it's just a black and white ethical issue. Do you see? So you probably shouldn't smoke pot. You probably shouldn't take heroin or sniff glue. Shouldn't drink Sterno. You know, probably shouldn't rob a bank or start a pyramid scheme and swindle investors out of $40 billion. There are some things that are just, you know, absolute. So the point I'm making in terms of this healing crisis is that, it's going to be different for each person. But the person is going to have to be absolute. And the postmodern ego doesn't want to be absolute about anything. If you get a person at blooming level of development, they will understand absolute. They will, from a lower perspective. But they'll understand, I know I shouldn't do this and I won't do it because I shouldn't do it because it's a sin. But it's from a lower perspective. Mm-hmm. But if you get a postmodern person, like, who can judge? Why shouldn't I? What's the difference? It's my life, you have your truth, I have my truth. What does it matter? God's going to enlighten me when it's right for me to be enlightened according to God's plan, and we're all moving toward the light, and it's all the light. Did you see that thing, nonsense on the news group? Well, didn't a lot of good come out of the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Wasn't that an expression of God? No. The Holocaust wasn't an expression of God. It was an expression of human choice, and it was evil. And the good that came out of it wasn't an expression of God. It was based on human choice, and it was an expression of the divine. But God didn't do it. Humans did it. And God didn't create the Holocaust. Humans did it. So this new agey kind of, well, it's all an expression of God. So, you know, apartheid and Nelson Mandela, it's God doing all of it. God's doing all of it, and God will enlighten me when the time comes. No. Yes, Anna?
I have 2 questions. So I'd like to be able to ask both of them because I've been wondering about this for a long time. When you talked about the difference, you talked about being willing to crucify ourselves, which means we hang our ego on the cross. But unlike the Christian myth, you know, it's not going to go up in the sky
and we're not forever.
So we're going to see it hanging there, yet we decide to act.
We may have to bear it forever. We don't know.
Right.
We're not doing it because we're going to feel better.
Not doing what?
We're not crucifying the ego because then we get to feel better.
Right.
In fact, there may be times where we feel miserable because we're so identified with the ego, but we're not going to act out of it.
Right. So heaven on earth is when it's still hanging there, right? It's with us, and we.
Yeah.
So have this interest in this heaven on earth.
The presence of ego The fact that your mind is completely insane,
yes,
or that you're having very difficult emotions,
yes,
or excruciatingly painful thoughts,
yes,
isn't in the way of the emergence of heaven on earth. And it's not proof that there's a problem. See, remember when I first had that experience I was talking about, these thoughts would come in my head and I'd be outraged they were there. I thought, why are they still there? This is a big problem. They should be gone. Leave me alone. And I had this highly victimized relationship to the fact that I still had an ego, which is ego,
yes,
itself. But being if we want to be free, we can be free even though we still have egos. That's a whole different enlightenment than the traditional mythic Eastern enlightenment, which suggested that to be free you didn't have an ego. So what we've been doing for the last 50 years pursuing enlightenment is using the fact that we do have egos as proof that we're not enlightened, which means we're off the hook for taking responsibility for enlightened consciousness right now.
So,
but we're not off the hook.
So